Okay, so the title this year is Hazakehan Amreel Gibor HaMasoret, or in English, the rebellious elder of the hero tradition. This is based on a famous and notorious article by the same name that I read at YU some years ago, which some people, not entirely without justice, suspect is autobiographical. So make sure everyone has one. Okay, this is a shir that was originally, the article was originally titled as the Sikha L'Ma'amar Matif or Yachas HaHalakha L'Midnagdim L'Lishma. An introduction to a comprehensive article on the relationship of the halakha to those who oppose it for its own sake. What it was intended to be about fundamentally was a preliminary exploration of the right of conscience in halakha, or another way of framing it is of the legitimacy of civil disobedience in halakha. Okay, right. That was the broader framework. I haven't quite written the comprehensive piece yet, so this is still just the introduction. But hopefully it has some. It still has. Yeah, I think so. I don't know if it appeared in the Yitzhak. It's on my. I think so. I don't know. Okay, so let me start by explaining, creating a context for this. The most well-known phrase in contemporary rabbinics today is Lo Bashamayim. Torah is not in heaven. Okay, what does it mean for the Torah not to be in heaven? So if you look at it, this is source number one. So Lo Bashamayim is a quote from a pasuk in Baran Perek Lamed Pasuk Yudbet. Now, if one takes this as a serious halachic verse, so there are certain implications. For example, the jurisdiction of the Sanhedrin doesn't extend to the other side of the Mediterranean. Right? Because if we learn that, right, things that, right, that says the Torah is not in heaven, therefore heaven doesn't have jurisdiction, right? So too, the Torah is not across the sea, right? So obviously, right, the immediate context of the text is not to establish physical areas of jurisdiction. And people usually take this as an irony, that when Rabbi Yirmiyah, right, when Rabbi Yeshua gets up and says, well, b'shamayim he, right, so he himself is taking the verse out of context, right, and saying, right, and therefore, right, transmuting the meaning of the verse. I'm not 100% sure that that's what's going on, but we'll just take that as an opening point. Okay. In the Pesukim, lo b'shamayim he seems to be designed to get rid of an excuse. Right, one might be of the opinion that the Torah was unknowable to ordinary human beings, and the answer is no. There's no reason for you to rely on anybody else. Now, you don't have to say who's going to get the Torah for us. The Torah is in everyone's mouth and heart, which sounds like it actually is affirming. Right, a notion of conscience as opposed to opposing it. Right, the Torah is in everyone's heart. Jurisprudentially, right, where this is famous from the Gemara of Matia, right, in which Rabbi Yeshua uses this to respond to Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Eliezer claims that he knows what the truth is in a particular case because. And he brings heavenly proof for this. Rabbi Yeshua gets up and says, "Lo b'shamayim." So, if one presumes that divine confirmation is the best evidence of truth, so it seems that this text really denies the notion of any kind of direct access to truth. Truth always has to come through the system. Okay, for a number of other places in which "Lo b'shamayim" is used. One of which is just notable for it, so you all know the core for the joke. This is Varim Rabbah, in which Shmuel says, Lo b'shamayim hi, Shmuel amar ina Torah mitriyah ba'astrologin shum nafam b'shamayim. Okay, there's no Torah in astrology. Amar l'shmuel, v'riyata estrogolus gadol b'torah. But you know astrology, and you're a gadol in Torah, so why do we assume the Torah can't be found among astrologers? So you need to say the Torah is not found in astrology. So the Torah is not found among astrologers. So they said, but you're an astrologer, right? So she says, lo hayiti mabit astrologia elo b'shach hayiti panoi min haTorah. Right? He said, I only engaged in astrology when I was free from Torah. Emetai, when is this? B'shach hayiti nitzin lo beit hamayim, when I went to the bathroom. So the joke about the Vilna Gaon is actually Midrash, about Shmuel, right, that he was. So the Vilna Gaon only learned that from the bathroom.
Yeah.
Right, that's funny, it's a Midrash. It's not a story about the Vilna Gaon, it's a Midrash about Shmuel. Jokes is a very old joke. Or serious, if you wanted to prefer to take it seriously. I think it's a joke. So I just read, I have to say, on the web, I was just reading, somebody sent me a super email about the Slipkin controversy that the Perim, and one of which they included a letter from somebody who described a Rabbi Bowman bathroom reading and how overwhelmingly impressed he was. He went into the bathroom and he saw this incredibly broad range of books, and you see how involved he was. Presumably there were no books anywhere else in the house, just in the bathroom. Okay. So we have Lo Bashamayim here. At the outset, it has what I would call really two almost contradictory meanings. On the one hand, in the pasuk it seems to say that one should have a self-sufficient capacity to learn Torah. Right? On the other hand, it's used in Gemara v'Metzia to reject any notion of direct relations to Torah. Torah comes through the system. Now you can reconcile that by saying that that when Moshe says "Lo nitzlitzi minchavla rechokahi lo b'shamayim b'leimor mielo noshamayma," means you don't have to wait for you don't have to ask somebody to go up to heaven. You just have to ask somebody to go up to Har Bayis and you can receive the Torah from the authority of the Sanhedrin. At the very least, it seems to argue that the power of the Sanhedrin does not come from any kind of supernatural force, rather purely by rational means, right? So it has to be, it's opposed to, but right, if you treat Lo Bashamayim as establishing the authority of Sanhedrin, the point is the authority of Sanhedrin is opposed to any kind of Ruach HaKodesh, which is problematic, because the power of Sanhedrin seems to come from resting precisely in Lishkat HaGavit, which most people think is a Ruach HaKodesh concept. On one level, we can say that we have a tension in two concepts of Lo Bashamayim. One seems to be based on the Tzukim, seems to be that you have the right that you have access to Torah yourself, and the second seems to imply that your direct access to Torah is irrelevant. Torah is only derived through the Sanhedrin. Okay, and the more famous meaning is certainly the second, right? People derive that since the Torah is not in heaven, therefore human beings have authority over Torah. The human beings have authority over Torah through the process of halakha, which includes the authority of the Sanhedrin, and therefore independent knowledge or conviction should have no force at all.
You know, the first three psukim are in plural, and the fourth is singular.
Yes. You can work in either way, I think.
Well, I was actually going to ask a question somewhat related to that, which is that to be assuming that the Gemara and Bava Metzia implies that Rabbi Eliezer has no right to have it, or as you could say that Lo Bashamayim simply means that the other stations of the Sanhedrin cannot be compelled to accept him.
Okay, very good. Mm-hmm. All right, we could.
Lo Bashamayim could be defending the collective process against claims of special power by
the individual. Okay. So very, very good. So one could say, as Rebecca suggests, that maybe Lo Bashamayim just creates a standoff, not a victory for the majority, but a capacity for both majority and minority to maintain their opinions. As Professor Halibny points out, I think very correctly, that the story in Bava Metzia is actually somewhat ambivalent, because Rabbi Eliezer ends up being able to destroy a third of the world and to kill Rabbi Gamliel, mm-hmm. which seems to imply that something was done, right? That there was some element of injustice towards him was in the story. Also, many people. Yeah, also, it's in the context of Onad Dvarim. Exactly. So usually this is understood, and I still take this as the simplest reading, that they had the right to overrule him, but since he did not either act on or tell others to act on the basis of his position, they did not have the right to put him in peril. All right, Rebecca wants to say we can take it further. Maybe they have no right to compel him to do anything. All the Shemayim give them the freedom from him. It doesn't give them the freedom to do anything to him. So we're going to bracket that. I hadn't thought of that really. And that's possible. Yes. But it's mostly taken from Halibut. Okay. That's one thing. Another famous element, which I would say is almost culturally dispositive on this issue, is that on the pasuk "Losasur Mikol Shegidu L'Chayamin Esmol," Rashi quotes the Sifri who says, "Afilu Omer," or Rashi quotes the Sifri as saying, "I believe Afilu Omer L'Chayamin Shesmol V'Osmol Shemin Shmalahem," and that one is supposed to listen to the Sanhedrin, even if they tell you that left is right and right is left. So I just point out to you, this is the bottom of the first page, that actually there are two versions of that midrash, one in the Sifri and one in Shir HaShirim Rabbah. In the Sifri, as we have, and again, all these effects will shift in manuscripts. Right? One version of this, Afilu Marin Deinecha Alimin Shir Smol Vol Smol Shir Yamin Shmalahem, and the other is Afilu Omer Lecha Alimin Shir Smol Vol Smol Shir Yamin. And those texts are different. Right? One possibility is that the Sanhedrin in fact has the power to determine the law in error. Right? Even if you are absolutely certain, right, without beyond the shadow of a doubt that they are in error, their power wins. The other one, the text that we have actually in the Sifri, is more problematic. It says even if it seems to you, they're telling you left is right and right is left. Now at that point, one can start getting complicated and saying, well, what's the boundary between seems and know? Right? If you can know, maybe then you shouldn't listen to them. Right? It's only if it seems to you that right is left and left is right. There's a little bit more room to play with that notion. Once it says seems as opposed to is, but culturally. Right, what everyone starts with are those two famous statements. One is Lo B'Shamayim, the Torah is not in heaven, and therefore, even though Eliezer knows he's right, he should have given in to the right to the pages. And number two is, even if they tell you that right is left and left is right, you have to listen to them. Right? And from all that, when it comes to the conclusion, and this is drawn from an article by Yitzhak Twersky, not the former professor here, but a nephew, I believe, or something like that. Who wrote an article in Beit Yitzchak years ago about whether the Sanhedrin discovers or creates the law. All right, classic issue in Israeli jurisprudence. And he pretty much, I think, came to the conclusion that the Sanhedrin creates the law. And this is the kind of evidence you cite. Right, it seems that the law is whatever the Sanhedrin decides it is. Okay, as against this, I have a very simple point, which is that this sounds very compelling, except it denies an entire parak in the Torah, basically. Because Vayikra, Parak Dalet, Sukkim Yud Gimel through Chazala are about what happens if Sanhedrin makes a mistake. Okay, this is Midrash Halakha, right? So I'm not claiming that I know that I read the pshat of Chumash against Gemara. Just Midrash Halakha says that when it says Im Kol Adat Yisrael Yishuv and Alam Devar Minei HaKahal, that means if most of Kol Yisrael sins on the basis of a mistaken ruling by the Sanhedrin. Okay, mistaken ruling by the Sanhedrin. You got it. Sounds like the Sanhedrin can make mistakes. So yeah, I started this just, you know, with a very very simple question. Like, how can it be that we declare that the law is what the Sanhedrin says it is, if there is an entire parsha of the Torah, which is all about mistakes by the Sanhedrin and how we correct them? Okay. So that's our opening question. At the same time, I don't want to use this to say that all the classic readings are wrong. Right? There is a reason for this cultural position. Right? There is a very strong basis in the tradition. Right? The text, in fact, right, does use Lo B'Shamayim to establish the authority of the Sanhedrin. There is, in fact, in the literature, says that people only look how they mention the small, even if they write is left and left is right. So how do we reconcile them? Okay. So, it seems to me that if one wishes to maintain both of those traditional texts and the Torah, then the solution that one would have to come to is that the Sanhedrin are the law, but the law is not necessarily right. Okay, right. That's the only right that one can draw a distinction between the positive law, so to speak, right, and the duty of the individual. In particular, right. Let's frame this most sharply. The pasuk that Rashi quotes as telling you that you have to listen to the Sanhedrin, even if they tell you right is left and left is right, is the entree to the parsha of what we call the Zakein Mamre. Right, the elder rebels against the Sanhedrin and is executed as a result. Okay, so if we were to say that the solution, that the proper solution is that in fact the Sanhedrin, the majority determines the law, but anyone who violates the law, is subject to execution, but that nonetheless there are times in which the Sanhedrin errs. Well, we have to go one step further. So there are times when the Sanhedrin errs. So what is one supposed to do when the Sanhedrin errs? Okay, we can solve this problem very simply by saying that, you know what, we understand that the Sanhedrin can be an error, but your duty is to follow the Sanhedrin right or wrong, right? The law triumphs. Okay, that would be, right? And that would be taken, if you take Rashi, a few only the following inch of the small, or small shin inch, small lamb, right is left, then we have no difficulty. The problem is, and here we're in source sheet number 2, okay? If they're not in, on page 2 of the source sheet, in the heading number 2. So the Mishnah Horios Terek Aleph, Mishnah Aleph says the following. Horu beitin lavor lachat nikola mitzvot ha-morot ha-torah, ve-halas ha-yachid v'asta shogeg al-pihem, ve-in sh'asu v'asai mehen, ve-in sh'asu v'asa aferihen, ve-in sh'asu v'asa matur mitnation t'lava v'itim. Okay, the Sanhedrin, the beitin here refers to the Sanhedrin, rules in a way which causes one to transgress any of the negative commandments in the Torah, which cause one to bring a korban chatat as a result, right? Which means something that is shirgo chatat is going to occur as a nisa. So then, if you acted on the basis of their ruling, you don't bring a separate sacrifice. Okay, the sacrifice, but again, there are many conditions to be met. The way we come out is it has to be an error that most of the Kol Yisrael participated in. But there are conditions that can be met such that the only sacrifice that needs to be brought is the pork sacrifice, right? And you are not liable at all because you just relied on them. Okay, so far that's great. They said right with left, you followed them, you're fine. Right? Okay, but then the Mishnah says the following. Horu beitin v'yodah chad mehen shato. If the beitin ruled and one of them knew that the ruling was an error, oh, tell me the roy of the hurrah, whether it was a student, not a member of the court, but if somebody who is capable of issuing halachic rulings. The halach v'asal pihen, he then went and behaved on the basis of their ruling. Bein sh'asu v'asai men, bein sh'asu v'asai chorehen, bein sh'lo'asu v'asa, harei zechayev, v'pnei sh'lo t'ala b'vekin. He does have to bring his own sacrifice, because he did not rely on the court.
Wait, what did he do? Did he follow them or not?
He followed them. Yeah. He followed them. Whether they did it themselves or not, he did it before them, he did it with them, he did it after them, they never did it. It doesn't matter. He always has to bring his own sacrifice because he cannot use the claim that he's relying on the courts. He's not relying on them. What do you mean he's not relying on them? Right? If he's a member of the court or a competent scholar, he should know that right is left and left is right. He's not relying on them that it's true. But he's relying on them, that's what he's supposed to do. So what's the issue? Yeah.
I see, I was looking at the sources. Ramban.
Look at it, don't worry about it.
I know.
Don't worry. It's in the article.
What?
It's in the article.
Yeah, okay.
Just put that.
So then I didn't see it in the...
Don't worry about it. It's there. Okay.
Was that a call?
Okay, the general rule is, if you rely on yourself, right, if you're acting on the basis of your own position, then you're fired. And if you act on the basis of the Beis Din's position, you're pater.
I thought this guy did go on the Beis Din.
No, the court ruled. And now, the court ruled in error.
Right.
And this person followed the court's ruling.
Right.
Doesn't matter. The court's ruling is irrelevant to his own liability.
So that doesn't go under the cloud.
It is, because he's called that Atzmo. Even though the court ruled, We can't, right, he cannot claim that he's acting on the basis of the court because he knows better. Right, because he's somebody who should know better. The court's error is irrelevant to his error. He makes his own error.
Yeah, just rely on the court. They don't know.
Well, all we have is they have a distinction. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So what kind of error is he making? So the Yerushalmi says, right, that what he's doing is Elishu Ketoa Lomar Torah Amra Acharehem. Okay. There's a whole long discussion about what that means, right? If he's making a mistake, he thinks the Torah says follow them, and he thinks that means follow them, no matter what. But that's wrong, right? And finally, right, right. Since he's holding against the position, and we now quote a bright that Yerushalmi, which says, "Tehadot Yisrani," at the end of the only, "Yachol im yomer lechal yamin shul smol v'al smol shiyamin shmalahem, tamed lomar lelechet yamin shmol shiyomer lechal yamin shiyamin v'al smol shul smol." No, so the correct reading, says Yerushalmi, is the follow-up right that which says, only if they tell you right is right and left is left. So if they tell you right is left and left is right, don't follow them.
So he mixed up. He got that wrong.
He got that wrong.
And he was depending on his own interpretation, which was wrong.
He is depending on his own interpretation, which was wrong. But not his own, right? The only, Yerushalmi ends up, this is a case where he makes, right, the mistake he's making is that he thinks he's supposed to follow them.
Right.
So when do you have to bring a court order for missing the same
passport?
Well, it's not that you ended up doing it, doing the same of error.
Granted, I'm saying that that was the liability, it was the following. It just seemed like where the mistake lies
that doesn't affect it, right? He's still liable for bringing a sacrifice for doing that. And the reason is, he can't say I relied on them because he should have known. Right, first of all, he knew they were wrong. Right, or he should have known they were wrong. And secondly, so what? Either if he didn't know they were wrong, what's he doing acting? The answer is he made two mistakes. Right? Well, he made the same mistake. Well, actually, no, this kid only made one mistake. Right? He knew they were wrong, but he made the mistake of following them. Okay, the Babli says the same thing. Right? Look at the other line. It says, Kigon de Yada de Astur. Right? He knew that it was prohibited. He made an error, and he thought there was an obligation to listen to the sages even though they were wrong. But this itself is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so on a pure stock level, one should point out that the pure stock level, that the, we would just say, well, there's a Sifri on the one hand which says left is right and left, even if right, left is right and right is left, is again both the Yerushalmi and the Babli. It's pretty clear how we paskin. Right? We paskin that you're not supposed to follow the Sanhedrin when they're wrong. Now, this happens not to be culturally the case, which is an interesting phenomenon. Right, from a historical perspective, it's because Rashi takes the other one. There have been attempted solutions, where David Tzvi Hoffman, for example, points out there actually are two psukim, which say, and he applies one to a communal context, one to an individual context. But let's take a take. Right?
I mean, I would argue that's totally, but hope it's a political aspect. So next, we're actually at section here, right?
Ah, okay, I don't remember that section. I read the article, but I don't remember the section.
Yeah, hold on. So we're actually asking, at 1.1, and I forget, is Schubert tends to harmonize them, but I think in his German book, he actually says, this is my focus.
I don't remember if I had the German book translated for me on this or not.
But maybe available in Hebrew.
No, it was available at YU. It was available. We had it. I just don't remember if I had it really been translated for me or not.
No, but I think it was translated in Hebrew itself.
That would be after. Okay, I'll have to go back and look at your article.
Thinking about this today, I wouldn't.
Okay.
Most people try to harmonize. Maybe because of that, they sometimes try to harmonize the two.
Yeah.
They're speaking about different situations.
And I'm fine with that. They're all sorts of clever, right? This Yitzchak has a marvelous way out, which he says that there are times when the court has to rule that right is left and left is right, because not about what the law is, but about the, in a particular case, in order to prevent injustice. The court has the right to deliberately misconstrue the law. So as to create equity as opposed to law. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, you got to think of this one. Okay. We'll put that in each other later. We'll put that in each other later. Okay. Now, who is the person who's supposed to, one last thing is the halacha. The Rambam says the same thing. Right, look at the Rambam. Shigi goes, you're going to love it. Hey? Right, what's the case? The yada'a chad in the kahal shita'u b'shechelach ha'keva asur y'achlu mitnei hora'ato shahaya ole al da'atan shemitzvah lishmol v'vezdin apathi shahen koin. Right, because they were of the opinion, mistakenly. No one's supposed to follow the court even though they are mistaken. Okay, now this of course leads to a crisis because at this point, right, the court has no authority. So anytime somebody wants to act against the position of the court, they'll just claim, well, I think you're wrong. Right? What power does the court have? If we allow people to make a claim that they believe the court is wrong?
But not just anybody. It's limited to someone who's a
power. Good. So, right, so ordinary people have no right to make such a claim. We have a particular person in authority. Now, here is where I'm going to claim that. So it's not everybody who is subject to the death penalty in this case either. And it's only a zakein who is subject to the death penalty. It's only somebody of a high level. And interestingly enough, it's only somebody of a high level who is obligated to not listen to them. So now the question is it possible that these are the same person? And in fact, right, the person who is executed for not listening to the court is precisely the person who is required to not listen to the court, which would explain how a sage of such great merit could end up being executed. Okay, right. So that's right. That's the opening suspicion, right? It's interesting that, on the first glance, right, that it seems that these apply to the same figure. Okay, so I came up with initially six axes along which one could try and distinguish the halakha of the zakein mamre, the person who's executed, from the halakha of parhel and devar shel tibur, which is the person who's not allowed to follow them. Okay, first is the person who actually does the action. Okay, so who are the people who actually do the action? Okay, right, section 3, I just gave you the halacha of Zakein Mamre, and then he gets executed, in case you didn't believe me. Okay, so we're now in section number 4. Right, so what are the criteria for being a Zakein Mamre? So the Gemara says that he about ki palayim chadavar. That means the mutla should have eaten a katuv and daber. Okay, we don't know what that means, so I'm just filling it in there for you. The Mishnah says that a talmid shahor lasa sputter. Okay, somebody who's just a student, even though he rules in practice against the high court, nonetheless is not executed. Okay. What does the Rambam say? The Rambam says, in zaken mamre chayav misa, ad shihe chacham, v'yigia lahura, samuch, okay, it has to be somebody who is a chacham, who has reached the status of hura. The phrase samach b'sanhedrin is somewhat problematic. I'm going to translate here as somebody who is fit, to, right, has the kind of smicha that would be fit to make him a member of the Sanhedrin. Okay? The Mishnah Horios tells us that who is the person who has to disagree with the court? The yada echad mehen shito, either somebody who actually was a member of the court, or a student who reaches the level of hara. So there we are again, right? The phrase royal hara, and the Rambam formulates this in Shigi with Yimohei as chacham o talmid sheyigia lehara. So it seems to me pretty clear that the standard is the yigia lehara, and the standard to become a zakein mamre and the standard to not rely on the court are the same. Okay, axis number 2. Number 2 is who are the people whom one has to disagree with in order to become a zakein mamre or to bring a korban chatat. So the answer is, if you look in the Mishnah Sanhedrin, you only become a zakein mamre. So the Rambam says, let's skip the Mishnah, which says the same thing, but the Rambam Hilchos Mamre Perek Gimel says, Until he gets to the point, oh Yahshu Alpira ourselves, Yahlokalihan, the Hain Yoshin Delishka Tagodis. Okay, it has to be the Sanhedrin Agadol who is in the Lishkat HaGavit. And the Nishan Horeos also says that the Parhalim Davarshal Tibur, right, says, Re'en Chayavim Ela Horeos Beitin HaGadol Bilvad. Okay, so there too, right, and there too it requires the Beitin HaGadol. So it's the same,
For the guy who follows them when they're wrong.
Yeah. It's the same, it's the same court it's the same court in each case. Okay, access number three was the nature of the ruling. Okay, and there too, in the Zakin Mamre we just read, it only chayev if he does it, or if you look back in Mamre Per Gimel, it says v'yore lasa kihoraso o yasuhu al kihorato v'yachlo kohen. Okay, either if he rules and backs it, or if he acts on the basis of his own ruling. And this is source number, label number six here, that Shmuel says, the olam ein beitin chayavin ash yomer lehem v'tarn atem, v'avidim in adai yomer, ash yomer lehem v'tarn atem la'atos. Okay, so there too, right, the ruling, right, the ruling is only if you, right, only if you, the parlam devar shel tibur comes only if you actually rule in practice. You can't get of it by saying, "Oh, it's a zaken mamre," right? Everybody gets a practical ruling, and a right, and parallel divergent. And you disagree if it's not yet practical. Right? Both cases are discussing rulings that are engaged in, right, are engaged in effect. The Sanhedrin itself has to rule to, right, has to rule to be in practice, and. Sorry, I should have quoted the first section to the end, right? It says, oh, it's source number six. Amar Rabbi Apanan Namitina, Chazar Le'iro, Shana Velinik, Derish Linit. Pater Hor Lasso is Chayat. Right, so there's actually, the Gemara actually draws an explicit parallel between the Hora of the Zakeh Namre and the Hora of the Beit Din. Okay. You could talk about the nature of the error. You could have the nature of the error. Okay, so parallel endeavor shel tzibur is only brought if the Sanhedrin made some kind of mistake that is called a mistake in hora. Okay, what kind of mistake is called a mistake in hora. So it seems from a very dangerous Gemara in Yevamah Daf Tzadi Bet Amud Aleph, which I should just put into play. Gemara Daf Tzadi Bet Amud Aleph, which you'll see under source number 7, seems to imply that a mistake in fact is not a hora. A Sanhedrin errs in terms of fact, that has no legal force at all. If we read the Gemara together, Nisei Sopi Beitin Teitei V'chule, Amar Shmuel, Let Abediri, Let the Limithnisim Yitani Bei Midrasha, the Tani Bei Midrasha, this is what we're interested in. Hora Beitin Sheshach Achama V'Lebesel Zarcha, Okay, so Sanhedrin rules that the sun has set, and then the sun comes out. So the Bei Midrash says this is not a hora, rather it is just a mistake. Okay, there's a whole, right, whereas Rav Nachman says that that too is a hora, and there's a whole discussion about what that should be. But the simple treating of this Gemara is going to end up saying that a mistake in fact is not actually, right, it's not actually hora.
The difference is whether you bring the carbon or go through the whole.
Yeah. Okay. There's also, right, we also have a halacha, right, which is the big, right, that you don't bring a parlin devar shel tzibur if the Beit Din makes a mistake that is so obvious that, right, that even the tzaddikim would agree. Okay. We don't really know what that means because it's not at all clear that the historical tzaddikim actually read the Torah so simply. That we can use the Varsha Tzuki Modimbo as simply meaning the obvious meaning of the words. But let's take it in the Sefer Horios, the Varsha Tzuki Modimbo seems to mean that, although I wouldn't vouch for the original context. It may just mean something that's a cultural consensus. So they should have known something about that. So one could argue that the only that the only case in which the individual is supposed to rule against the Sanhedrin is if they erred in fact. Right, one can make that distinction, right? That one, if they err in fact, and when it's Zaken Mamre, if you disagree with them in law, and when it's not Zaken Mamre, if you disagree with them in fact. And I think actually, Vitorsky's article actually in Beit Yosef Shaul Gimel, I think he made such a claim. I haven't found any evidence of such a distinction anywhere in prior rabbinic literature. Nor have I found any claim that one does not become a Zaken Mamre if one argues that the Beit Din made a mistake in fact.
Wherever here is Mr. Mishra Krishna Gemara, the one Sanhedrin made a mistake with, setting the month and Hashem changed the stars as he went up. You're saying that, it's a thing of non law.
Doesn't say anything about the stars change.
No. So, in some sense,
there's a famous story of the Shurim Gamliel where they change it, where they get the done from. But it doesn't say that the reality changes to shift them.
Yeah.
The only place in which people make a claim that reality shifts to a Kali Halacha is virginity.
Virginity
returning for a woman who has sexual relations at the end of her third year, and then they declare a leap year. Since we rule that virginity returns, that the sex doesn't eliminate virginity before you're 3 years old, so you think you're more than 3 years old that time, right? We think that she's more than 3 years old, and then we declare a leap year. So it turns out retroactively she wasn't 3 years old. So that's right. So that the Ron takes the position that reality actually shifts to adjust the law. Most people don't take that, but I have to be honest. Honestly, be honest and say that the Ron Olerit does, so far as I remember, suggest literally that reality shifts.
Well, in certain sense, in the Gemara you're referring to that turning month, in terms of that, if you look at Rabban's commentary, Chumash, he sees that as not a specific halacha. He quotes it with Yom Tov, and so for him, that's really paradigmatic. That's not a special example, but it's always, whatever they say, on the other hand, like the Rabban never quotes Yom Tov. And presumably that's limited specifically only
to the calendar. To any broader conclusions. We're going to get to them,
I promise.
It's all part of the same position. It's all part of the same. Ramban is always, it's consistent all
over.
Yeah. So I want to point out that, again, to me the major point is that nobody, to my mind, has ever suggested that one does not become a Zaken Mamre because one claims that the court's ruling was an error of fact as opposed to law. You want to claim that you don't bring the korban, that's fine. But you're still going to be left with a case, in which the court will believe that it has established the law, and you're going to believe that they're in error. You're obligated to act against the court, and your obligation to act against the court compels you to become a Zaken Mamre and therefore be liable for execution. Okay, you can try to distinguish based on the content of the Horaot. We'll discover that both of them relate to Horaot that discuss things that your chayav achatas for to do by accident, and in fact, there's a position that we learn the two from each other by Gzeira Shava. Right, so you can't distinguish on those grounds.
He has to bring the achatas only once the Sanhedrin agrees that it was a mistake. If they don't find that they made a mistake, then
he
never brings it to
the Chatas. Well, I don't know. What happens if he thinks he made a mistake and they don't agree anymore? Then certainly he should bring it to. There's no possibility they could rely on them if they haven't agreed to it.
If they haven't agreed with him, right. He doesn't bring the Chatas.
How do we know?
That's how I read it.
I'm not so sure. Now, the question is, right, because if he brings the Chatas, now, really, here's where we start getting up the case. He thinks he made a mistake, right? So now he wants to bring the Korban Chatas. But they're going to rule that if he tries to bring the Korban Chatas, he's being knocked in school in Lazara. Right, which is usher.
Maybe you could say that it's only when they change their mind that then he has to be.
You could say that.
Okay.
But I don't.
I mean, it helps you with that.
Well, if you want to be helped. Right, you have to want to be helped. I don't necessarily want to be helped.
Okay.
the right, so the first five axes, which is who is the one who disagrees, who are the people making the ruling, what's the nature of the ruling, what's the nature of the mistake, what's the content, right, what's the content of the ruling, all those seem to be identical. Right, so the last one is what about the action that he right, what is it that the Zaki Mamre actually does? Okay. So according to the Gemara Sanhedrin, and according to the Rambam, although this is not obvious in the Mishnah, the halacha is that a Zaken Mamre is chayev, either if he acts, or if he rules, right, or if he rules to act. Okay, it's not 100% clear from the Mishnah that his action should ever be significant. It might just be that his ruling is significant. But the Rambam says explicitly, right, that, right, if you look again at Perakim HaLachahei, says, oh, Yatahu al Pir, I'm in section 8 now, right? So Ain Zakin Mamre Kayev Nisa, Ad Shehe, Chacham Shehigil Ora, Samach the Sanhedrin, the Yachalok al Beit Medavar Shadona Kurish the Shigigaso Chatas, O Basilin, the Yor Elasas Kiraso, O Yatahu al Pihoraso. Okay, so you have, right, so the Rambam thinks that you can become Chayev either by ruling or by, or by doing.
Doing
except
is a piece of
the truth. Wait, let me take a question on you. Yeah.
What's the deal with
the that's if you look at in the Gemara and Netanyahu, there's a whole long drasha about it. The only thing that has chatas, and then they make it, they write the limits to fill in, and fill in gets stuck in there. I don't have a rational explanation for it, fill in gets stuck in there. Yes. Okay, yeah, but what do you want to ask?
No, I'm not convinced. The season is asymmetry. I'm not convinced Hassan Sofer is right. Namely, with Yoreh, when you Yoreh Lassos, it can be either the cool or the cool. When you say something is usher and I think it's moved today, something is Sesmeser, and I think it's usher and I'm telling you. And not only I think that, but I'm telling you to ignore what they say, and you can follow, and you should follow, and you should follow me. Yatahu, the Atmo, seems to be the only case with it where they say something is usur, and he thinks...
Oh, you're done again. Okay. Wait. Okay. So what I have now, is a claim. Right? That it seems to me that there is an identity between the person who is obligated not to listen to Sanhedrin and the person who is executed for not listening to Sanhedrin. Okay. Most people intuitively think that that is a contradiction.
Mm-hmm.
Can't be the same person. So then we try and find answers. So one answer is, right, this is the Ramban's answer mentioned before, is to say that you're obligated to follow your own opinion until such time as the Sanhedrin has had the capacity to listen to your opinion, but once they've had the opportunity to listen to your opinion, right, so then you're obligated to follow them. Okay, that's the solution that Ramban brings in his Parish of the Sefer Mitzvot, to which I have two point responses. One is, if that were correct, the Gemara, instead of saying, right, going through all the contortions and coming out, oh, somebody was told in this solution, oh, we chachamim, right, that's the case, you bring your own korban, should simply say you bring your own korban if you didn't have a chance to argue with them. Right. If that answer were correct, then the Gemara is a much easier, both the Bavli and the Yerushalmi should have a simple solution. Right? Both the Bavli and Yerushalmi say, what should be the case if you bring your own korban? And they come up with a case, oh, somebody made a mistake and thought he was supposed to follow Sanhedrin when he wasn't. What's the issue? Say it's the case, right, where he wasn't yet supposed to follow Sanhedrin because he had a chance to listen to his own opinion.
He thought even if they give a ruling, he knows they're wrong, he
doesn't
have to argue for them. Because if they give a ruling, he could just somehow listen.
And he's right.
What?
No, he thought... Whether or not
he'd be wrong.
Okay.
Whether or not he would say that Gemara's the same case with the
Sanhedrin
gives a ruling, you know it's wrong, and then you think, well,
look,
you know, I know it's wrong, why don't I kill? They give a ruling, so I'll follow them.
But
that's an obligation. Well, that's a mistake. You have an obligation to bring all your objections.
To respond.
And it's the same. It's
Okay, three layers of response. One is that the that again, the Gemara would simply say much more simply, you're putting in two conditions, if only one of them is relevant, don't mention that one. Secondly, the one of the examples given in the Gemara and in the Rambam is somebody who actually was on the Sanhedrin. Right? How can you not have argued? He was there. Right? You can't have a greater case than that, right? You have to have that in the thirdly, and this is where it gets to my main point anyway, is, okay, good. So, suppose he presents his argument, and then they say, oh, we heard your argument enough. And then he says, no, you still haven't really understood my argument. And they say, enough! And he says, no. Right? So you're still going to get in a circle where they're going to feel they heard it. Right? And to me, right, the point of this in the end is that it's going to be unavoidable in the end, that there's going to be a case in which they're going to say, you know what? Right now you're hired to follow us, and he's going to say that's very nice, but I'm also hired to follow myself. Okay, one other way out. One other way out of this, and this was my teacher, Rabbi J. David Blythe's solution, is to claim that it's true that you're not supposed to follow the Sanhedrin if they're wrong. But there's a myth, right? One of the principles of Torah is that you're not supposed to do things to get yourself killed. So if disobeying the Sanhedrin is going to get you killed as a Zakei Mamre, so the reason that you shouldn't follow the reason that you should follow them is not because you should follow them when they're wrong. The reason you should follow them is to go on it. Okay, right, that is a very serious challenge. Right, if I really want to construct a case in which you're both obligated, in which you're obligated to follow your own opinion, even though they get you executed, so I have to construct a case in which, in fact, it is Yehoreg Eliyahu to follow the other people's opinion. Okay, so can we construct such a case? So the first thing is the presumption here is that you have the option of doing nothing. And if you do nothing, they can't kill you. Okay, so here I just point out there is a Gemara in there is Yerushalmi and Shabbos, which is quoted by both the Rish and the Rush in Halacha. Actually, I have it here for you from Yerushalmi and Avodah Zarah. This is in section number 9, Rav does not accept the ruling of Rebbe and Beit Dino that Shem and Achim is now mutter. Right, the halacha is about wine touched by non-Jews don't apply to oil. And Shmuel sends a message to him and says, right, if you don't eat, I'm going to call you a zakin mamre. And this is quoted by both the Rif and Rashi halacha. Now, how serious this is, I don't know, but here's a case in which they call him a zakin mamre, right, for being mutter, not doing something. So again, it's quoted by the Rif and Rashi halacha, but it's not actually a real case, right? Because it's after the Sanhedrin. I don't know how seriously to take it, but it seems to me that more directly, the claim that you cannot become a Zakin Mamre b'shev v'altaseh is not supported by the language of the Rambam. This is where Professor Kaplan was talking about earlier, where the Rambam says, let's look at it right again. Same shift. This one. It's in 9. What's the language where it says Ben Shema?
It's 9, the second one there, right?
Joseph Brown and Dallas Ben. The same focus. That's what it is. It seems to me that the simplest way of reading this is that there are two ways to become a Zakei Mamre. One is by ruling, and one is by acting. And here again, right, the rule, right, it says that this is the case, whether he's Masner or Mekil.
I would say this refers specifically to Haram.
You could. It's not the way that we've read it, so the Sam Sofer doesn't read it that way.
Yeah, the Sam Sofer doesn't read it that way.
And if you look at the Frankel Rambam, you'll see there's a whole list of people who have already disputed this issue. And Sayyid the Menachem also has been cited in Machlokas Balacha. Sayyid the Menachem and Machlokas Balacha also has the Makoros both ways. It seems to me that
Right. It seems to me that most likely one can become, the most likely reading here is that one can become a Zogin Mamre even by failing to act on the basis of the Sanhedrin. And one can come with a clever case, right? The other issue is, let's suppose that you have to act to become a Zogin Mamre. Okay, so now the issue is, can you ever be executed the other way for something that Shaved Al-Kasa? So here, there's a famous case of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, also the Chazon Ish, which deals with the question of whether you can commit murder passively. So Rav Chaim Soloveitchik famously takes, as Lisha ben Chaim Halevi, takes the position that in the Rambam, you can commit Ritzicha by standing still. The case that Rav Chaim comes up with is based on Tosfos. Tosfos comes up with this fairly grotesque case of somebody says, stand still, somebody says, I'll kill you if you don't stand still and allow me to throw you on that baby down there. So Rav Chaim believes that according to the Rambam, one is obligated to resist, because one is committing murder, one is committing murder by allowing oneself to be thrown on the baby. The Chazon Ish has a refinement of the case, in which you're not, because he thinks that if somebody else is going to throw you, so they're the murderer, you're not the murderer. So his case is somebody says, stand there on that ledge in which an ordinary wind will eventually knock you over onto the baby. Right? And if you move, I'll shoot you. So you have an obligation to move, rather than allow the wind to blow you off the ledge and onto the baby. So those are all cases, right? According to both the Chazon Ish and Rav Chaim, it worked out that according to Rav Chaim's right in the Rambam, that one can commit murder passively. And then we have to construct a case, right, in which according to the Sanhedrin, what you're doing is not murder, and therefore they can tell, right, and therefore they can tell you to move. Right, they order you to move. Right, but you feel that if you move, they order you to stand still. Right, so the Sanhedrin rules, that whatever the creature below you is, it's not a human being or it's not alive, and so it's not murder to stand there. But you are of the opinion they're mistaken, and the creature below you is in fact a human being. So the Sanhedrin orders you to stand still. To avoid violating the issue of the high man. Right? Because if you move, you're going to get killed. But you, of course, right, you are of the opinion that if you stand still, you'll be murdered, that you'll be committing murder. Therefore, you feel yourself compelled, you feel your prohibition against standing still, and therefore you move. Once you move, of course, you have actively violated the command of Sanhedrin, and everyone agrees that you're a second memory.
But you're also being killed by the murderer.
No, he said he would. Who said he, right in the end, he may not.
But if he doesn't, then you're not a Zogin Mamre because maybe you
should
have had better insight into the psychology.
There's an error in fascism. We can just deal with the case where it's still a Shabbos.
I'd like to go back.
Yeah.
The Rambam Hilchos Mamre and Daladet.
Yes.
The context is a context where it's clearly talking about a law not acting, because it's talking about Pekel Kayote with the Sleep and Live Up to Lot Corey, my time I thought was in the daily day, Davarzevi, a few Akamea coming. So we're talking about a case where we have, where the debate is on something which, after 100 steps, will lead to something which is
So
I think the point is, if they say something is usur, and you say give a hurrah that it's mutar, even though this is something which it doesn't involve.
The context is always hurrah. The issue is simply, right, in order for that hurrah to make you chayav, the hurrah has to become real in one of two ways. Either it has to be hurrah to somebody else to act, or you have to act yourself based on that hurrah. And the issue here, right, it's always going to be in the context of a row. There's no evidence.
All right. So we're talking about, you do the same
You do the same thing you tell somebody else to do. Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
Yeah.
You become right. There's no difference.
Okay. Yeah, that's true. I mean, so it doesn't prove the point.
Yeah.
I mean, so it's getting open for grace. Yeah. Okay.
And then I think you know.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's cool. So it seems to me that there is no way to avoid the existence of a case in which one is both executed as a Zakein Mamre and obligated not to follow Sanhedrin. Now you might think, okay, but you know, I have to construct a very outlandish case, right? You know, the chayim about passive murder, I have to construct a case of passive vodazara, or I have to rely on the reading, which I think is not a bad reading, but not the only reading, that you can become a Zakein Mamre if you being passive. And maybe you would say that kind of outlandish argument should not be allowed to generate this, right? That kind of wild case should not be designed to allowed to generate this weird result in which you are obligated to do something that the court is obligated to execute you for. Yeah, I came up with a case. Other than the case where it's because of Nevis, you wouldn't do it because it's because of Nevis.
Right. In this theory,
really, most of the time you should act on your own, and it just happens pragmatically you won't ordinarily become a Zakein Mamre because it'll execute you.
Right.
Sure. The principles are in opposition. Okay.
Why would they make Chayyot? And it's sort of like begging the question, you know, once they say you're Zakein Mamre, I admit that, then you sort of have the right, if you have the obligation not to listen, why can you make such a thing about this?
Okay, if you're a brisker, it's very disturbing to have the law solved by a purely pragmatic means. You know, have a purely pragmatic solution where in the end we say, you know what, you're right, the law yields this fascinating paradox, but we can make sure it never happens in real life, so who cares? Right? It's the Baladatish answer to a right, to Lumdish problem. Okay, I agree with you. I think
it's not just about, I mean, it's something that Baladatish is okay, but here it is.
Okay, I'll cover it by Rebbe Dimension. It's a territory that came up with the Baikasha, I should quote it. Okay. So now, right, so it seems to me that right, it's not making a claim, which you may or at this point already find convincing, that there has to be at least a case, and as some of you already get, that the existence of the case, right, is really just the dramatics, right, underlying it really is the claim that the mitzvah of the Easter of Lo Sasur, and the mitzvah of following the truth are in opposition to each other. And that's an essential tension. Okay, now the question is, should we try and find solutions to this and prevent the case from ever happening? Or should we argue that this is in fact an inevitable thing? So here's the quick, this is, if you go to section number 10, so there's the Gemara that I'm very fond of, Sanhedrin Seif Hanam Aleph, which says the following. Shlosha Bakidin, etc., right? This is part of the Sugya Zakein Mamre, right? Amar Rav Kahana, Hu Omer Nisi HaShmua, V'Hein Omer Nisi HaShmua. Okay, meaning that the individual, the minority, the person who's representing the dissenting opinion, states his position on the basis of tradition. V'Hein Omer Nisi HaShmua. And the majority takes their position on the basis of tradition also. Eino Ne'era, he's not executed. Hu Omer Kafsu Beinai, he said, this is my opinion, just based on reason. The Ein Omer Kafsu Beinai, and they said, this is our opinion, Ein Omer Neherog. No, he's not executed for that either. The Chol Shekin, Hu Omer Tiyashmu, the Ein Omer Kafsu Beinai, Ein Omer Neherog. And certainly, if he has a tradition and they don't, he's not executed. Achi Omer Kafsu Beinai, the Ein Omer Tiyashmu. The only time which a Zakein Mamre is executed is if he says, this is my opinion, and they say, we have a tradition. I'm going to take a jump, which is not the only way to read it, but I think is the simplest way of reading it, which is to say, not only is he only executed in those cases, but there's no warrant for saying that somebody is disagreeing with the opinion of Sanhedrin and meets all the other qualifications, right? And saying that he's wrong, he's not allowed to act on his own opinion, but nonetheless he's executed. So in this case, if he's not executed, it means that he has to follow his own opinion. Right? There's no mitzvah. Right, because since he meets all the other criteria, right, since he meets all the other criteria, if he's in violation of Lo Sasur, he would be executed. So that means that if Kahana believes that the authority of the Beitin to override minority opinions exists only if they have a tradition and he doesn't. If he's attempting to give a rational objection to a traditional opinion. Okay, he's trying to overturn precedent on the basis of it, on the basis of reason. Okay. Teda, Sharei Lohargo Sakavi Ben Mahalil. The proof of this for him is that we have a story in the Mishnah in Idios that Sakavi Ben Mahalil, all his life, maintained four opinions against the majority of Sanhedrin, and he was not allowed to become head of the Sanhedrin because he maintained these four minority opinions, but they didn't execute him. Okay, why didn't they execute him? Apparently because they, right, because he, right, he claimed the tradition. Okay, Rabbi Lezer Omer, Rabbi Lezer says, Afilu Omer Netiha Shmua, Vein Omer Tachu Beinenu. Even if he says, I have a tradition, Vein Omer Tachu Beinenu, and they say, oh, that's just our opinion. Nerad, he still executed a traditional Yarbu Machlokus to Israel, so this dispute should not multiply in Israel. Pragmatically, we can't afford to have people acting on their own opinion. Doesn't matter what the basis of their opinion is and our opinion is. We have to have a rule. Okay, the Intomar, the Neman Lohargu at the Kavim and Mahalel, if you want to ask why didn't they kill the Kavim and Mahalel, did they Shahura Alakulamasa? Because he only, right, because he only held his position theoretically and not practically. This is extremely difficult, Terrence. Right, it's the simple reading of the mission is obviously that the Kavim and Mahalel held his position practically as well, but we're interested in the halacha. Right? The actual terrorist is why they didn't kill the Kavya and Mahalo, according to this position, is that we see in the Gemara momentarily there's a dispute as to whether the court has the right to forgive the Zaken Mama or not. We ask him that they don't have the right to forgive him, but probably the earlier Sanhedrin ruled that they did have the right to forgive him. And that's what happened in that story. Okay, so we have this dispute between Rabbi Eliezer and Rav Kahana. Now on this dispute, there is no evidence that either Rabbi Eliezer or Rav Kahana has a tradition. Let's imagine this issue coming up. So Rav Lazar, Rav Kahana says, you know, you only become a Zaken Mamre if you don't have, right, if the other guy has a tradition. And Rav Lazar says, nope, you become a Zaken Mamre even if you don't have a tradition. And they say, good, let's vote. And they vote, and Rav Lazar wins. So now he turns to Rav Kahana, and he says, ah, so now you have to give in. And Rav Kahana says, why? Do you have a tradition? And Rav Kahana says, you have to give in, right? Because of the already rule, that Rav Kahana says, let's vote. So they vote. And Rav Kahana, you know, you can see how this goes on. How this goes on forever. Right, then all we have to do is construct the case so that it originates in one of the cases I've come up with. Right, and we've got, right, and you can see that clearly, there has to, right, clearly, right, clearly, there's going to be a case in which, right, the Sanhedrin is going to rule that somebody has to give in to their authority, and that person is going to believe that they're not allowed to follow that authority. Okay, now, the way I first came up with this piece was not because I was thinking about halacha. I think I tell the story frequently, that my friend Nathan Selman and I were, used to rag each other for their respective holes in our education, in particular, my lack of math and his lack of history. So we made a deal in which I agreed to read any math book he chose in exchange for his reading any history book I chose. So the math book he assigned was Gerda Wesher Bach, which I read without paying any attention, without actually doing the equations. And then I gave him Neil Sheehan's John Paul Van, A Bright Shining Light, and he said, well, since you didn't read the equations, I'm just going to look at the picture. But in the process of reading the text without doing the equations of Gerda Wesher Bach, I was introduced to the completeness theorem. Now, the completeness theorem is a claim that any system, and those of you who are math people will know this better than me, right? I'm going to claim to be a literate thing. that every system ultimately, every system, you know, conclusions based on postulates, right, derived by rules from postulates, right, will ultimately either generate a paradox, or will be, right, either be, right, means it will be incoherence, or you will not be able to demonstrate all the truths of the system within the system. Right? It'll be incomplete. It's either incomplete or incoherent. The standard sentence of this is, right, this sentence is true, but it cannot be proven from your axioms. Right? I think that's the sentence that formulates it, right? Because if it's true, then that demonstrates there's a truth that can't be proven from your axioms, so it's incomplete. Right? And, but if it's not true, right, so then it, right, then it generates the paradox that it's both true and false at the same time. So the first bit is true. Right? Okay. But it's a fancier version of the original, this sentence is false, right, true or false. Ultimately, what it means is that all systems, right, that, and this is what I think Russell was trying to solve in Principia Mathematica, right, that all systems, that self-reference ultimately forces all systems into either, into either incompleteness or incoherence. Right? At some point, every system, at the point where it becomes self-referential, will either have to admit that there's a truth outside itself, or it will have to generate a contradiction, or both. Okay, so after reading this, it suddenly occurs to me, gee, halacha, that's a system, it has postulates, it derives things from its postulates by law, so it must be that halacha is subject to this, right, to this same rule. Now at that time, the interest I particularly had was discussing the question of whether there's an ethic independent of halacha. And there are any number of people who like to argue that halacha was, right, that halacha was entirely self-sufficient and autonomous, right? They had read snippets of Lachic Mind, right? And so they were of the opinion that, halacha, that there should not ever be a need to appeal outside halacha in order to decide halacha, and therefore there was no ground for moral intuition or anything of the sort in halacha. So what I said was, well, it seems to me that by this, by that this argument proves to me in the abstract that that can't be so. Either halakha will generate a contradiction, or there will become a point in which everyone will have to agree that the only way out is to appeal to something beyond the halakha. So now what's the... So now, sure, it's an axiomatic system. Any system that has rules is fine. So the issue is, so what, where would the case of self-reference be? So the case of self-reference is clearly, right, the easiest case of self-reference in halakha is rabbinic authority. Okay, how do we know that the rabbis have the authority to interpret the Torah? Because the rabbis interpreted the Torah. To say that the rabbis have, right, to say the rabbis have authority to interpret the Torah. Therefore, any time, any case in which somebody claims that, right, rabbinic, right, that their reading of the Torah, right, limits the rabbinic capacity, right, that the anyone, somebody claims that my reading of the Torah is that the rabbinic reading of the Torah is not authoritative in this case, will generate, right, will generate that contradiction. A simple case of this, for example, Rabbi Lamb takes the position in an article in Hilchot Halachot that the that Rabbi Gamliel takes the position that Chazal only have the authority to make decrees to protect laws whose interpretation is not obvious. Obvious. Right. So if the law in the Torah is obvious, then there's no capacity to extend rabbinic decrees. If the law in the Torah is not obvious, then there is a capacity. I leave the argument out. But obviously, that creates, obviously, right, that creates the issue. What happens if they think it's obvious and I think it's not? Right? So they believe they have the authority to make decrees, and I don't, and there's no way to settle the issue. Right? But or what happens if, right, whatever, right, he takes Tanner Lamb's point, he claims that rabbis only have the right to interpret things which aren't obvious. Right, so obviously, right, so right, their interpretation is based on the claim that it's not obvious, and I claim that it's obvious. Therefore, you don't have the right to interpret, and right, we get into infinite loops.
And also, if you disagree with this principle.
Yeah. So once I realized that the incompleteness, you know, once I understood the incompleteness theorem to some degree, it seemed to me obvious that there has to be a case in halakha which generated this, and in fact, all cases in halakha which rest on the, which deal with the extent of rabbinic authority are going to be subject to the same reflexive loop. And that was just a matter of 3 months until I came up with the actual case, which demonstrated it, which to me, you know, the fun case is the Reb Chaim, you know, the guy standing on the wedge. So I solved the, problem. The outcome of this, right, so it seems to me that, first of all, I've proven a case. Secondly, when you understand that case, you see that that case is really just reflective of a broader principle. Thirdly, one understands that broader principle has to be because there is no way in the system of avoiding that kind of paradox. Okay, now, so on a theoretical level, right, that this has two implications. One is that, right, if one wants to reject this, the only way one can reject it is by claiming that there's a prior, that one has prior knowledge that it's impossible for halakha to generate a case in which somebody has an obligation to do something that other people have an obligation to kill you for doing. Okay, that, to me, if anybody were to make such a claim, at that point, at least when I wrote the article, I won the argument. Because they're already appealing to something outside halakha. Nothing in halakha says. Right, so you can't prove in halakha that you don't have an obligation to do something that the court
is,
right, it has to be moral intuition. Right, because you have to choose between incompleteness or incoherence. Right, so if people wish to resolve the incoherence, the only way to go there is, right, the only way to go there is by admitting incompleteness. So that was the fun intellectual argument. I don't know if anyone's mind was changed by it, but it convinced me. However, right, so on a surface level, right, what I'm comfortable saying is, if anyone thinks that the case I produced is impossible, right, there could never be a case in halakha in which I have an obligation to do something that the court has an obligation to kill me for, I'm happy to agree, as long as you realize that that conclusion does not emerge from halakha, it emerges from your moral intuition, and once we allow moral intuition into halakha, well, all sorts of things can happen. Okay, but let's suppose for now that I'm not wrong, right, or that your moral intuition is not against it. So, what does that mean? It means that halakha recognizes the distinction between the law as it's, right, between the law as it's enforced in society and the will of God. Right, and acknowledges that there are times, right, that the law, pragmatically, is not in heaven. Right, that's meaning number one is not in heaven. Right, the law, pragmatically, is not in heaven because, right, and therefore, society has to function on the basis of majority rule. But at the same time, there's a second meaning of Lo B'Shamayini, right, which is that people, right, which is that people with sufficient qualifications are capable of knowing what Torah is. And there are times when those clash to the point where, right, to the point where one can be obligated to put one's life on the line, as in all cases of civil disobedience, right, what gives civil disobedience dignity is that you're saying, I accept the authority of the law, and I accept all the punishments coming to me on the basis of the law, but I think that my responsibility, right, my responsibility is both to the law and to the truth. And so I'm willing to suffer the penalties of the law for the sake of the truth. Right, so it seems to me that what one has here then is a case in which halakha recognizes civil disobedience in the classic sense, which is that civil disobedience is legitimate, but only so long as one is willing to accept the penalties of the law, all right, up to and including execution. But then on a pure shot, lambda's level, one can try and figure out, what is this Zakin Mamre? Right, so if he teaches Zakin Mamre as somebody gone awry, right, somebody has gone off their rocker, so that would be one thing. Right? If you take him as a political figure, right, whose ego runs away with him. But if you look at the Rambam and, right, and the Gemara, everybody seems to go out of their way to say that the Zakin Mamre has to be somebody who is still, at the point of his ruling, fit to be on the Sanhedrin. Mm-hmm. Right? How could somebody who is fit to be on, right, how could we treat somebody as fit to be on the Sanhedrin if their ego has so run amok that they're willing to violate one of the key rights, they're willing to undermine the whole system of law, and they're willing to allow their ego. They don't even understand the basic principle that the Torah, right, that majority rule follows. Right? If we're going to say that they're making a simple error, right, they're mistaken as to what the nature of the law is. Right? They think that there's no mitzvah no divrei chachamim. Really, there is, so they should be shoving you. And they're making an error about the law. How can you ever have a Zakin Mamre? So it seems to me that what I have constructed is not merely a case of Zakin Mamre. It's the only possible case of Zakin Mamre. Right? The case of Zakin Mamre has to be somebody who is still fit to be on the Sanhedrin and cannot be making a legal error. Right? The only way in which you can have a Zakin Mamre is if somebody is doing what they are in fact logically compelled to do. Right. So right, which is why I ended my article saying, we'll see that. So it seemed like the faith of the Canaan, right? The El Gibor ben Nadir Chagi the Ironi. According to this, right, the way in which we have to relate to the rebellious elder is as a hero subject to a right to a tragic and ironic death, and obtain that show Lama Surat, the Shvil HaMasurat, the Altia Masurat. But he gives his life to the tradition for the sake of the tradition and on the basis of tradition. Right. Interesting. If you want the article is online in the Talmud section of SeminitAdress.org. At that point, he's not fit anymore. You could construct it, but it's hard. Right? If you look at the way the qualifications, they seem to go out of our way to say this is somebody who, up until that moment, is really a worthwhile human being. And to say it's just somebody whose ego, right, causes them to violate the law they know is wrong. There are four different ways you can read the argument. You can take the extreme case, you can take the principle, you can take the completeness theorem, you can take the overall theory, you have to buy all four.
Doesn't moral intuition come into our life all the time?
I think so.
Are you saying that outside the system or inside the system or it's not a system?
I'm saying there are people who make the claims, particularly in NYU. The halakha is a closed autonomous system. One should not be, right, and it should be rationally determinable. Truly rationally determinable. Right?
It's like we've seen many examples where
I don't think that's true. That's why I was happy to, just have that confession. I agree with you, that I didn't need this argument to convince me.
I'm just thinking last time somebody said, is it possible that Rabbi so-and-so never put on filling in his life? I mean, what principle was that?
Rabbi Lichtenstein saying that it's not possible that if an Italian river, right, never, was never Yotze.
Yeah, and so, on the basis of that, he draws the conclusion. So where did he get that principle about?
Yeah, I don't think Lichtenstein would take that position. But it was a quite prevalent position in my circles at YU.
He wrote
it. I was a student. But Rabbi Lichtenstein has an article in the Turn Ethics and Fellow College, which we talked about last time. I don't think. Well, what he ends up saying is that there are non-formal principles. Right? The claim that they were making, right, that my friends were making, was that you could treat halakha as a formal system.
And then you get the
completeness theorem. Absolutely. Right. So the article is written intellectually as an attack on the concept of halakha as a formal system. Right, it showed that halakha as a formal system is always going to be either incomplete or incoherent. They could pick which one they choose. It happens that I prefer the incoherence because I assume the incompleteness. I don't need that. I prefer the incoherence. What am I doing next week?